All right. Unfortunately, this time when you read it, you got the preposition right. My very strangely prepositioned university at Buffalo instead of and all the other variants that you can see in the program. Some of my starting points here, I want to begin by saying this talk I think is going to be much more conceptual than the other talks we've seen today. I think we could possibly classify it as a work of theoretical grammatography rather than applied grammatography. Hopefully it won't be too conceptual, but I want to sort of explore the idea of first starting with the idea that the web has really allowed us to completely rethink the nature of scholarly communication, right? There's a large dialogue by this, by other fields, not so much within linguistics, but somewhat within linguistics, but also within the hard sciences, especially, and also sciences like biology, et cetera. And if we really want to rethink the scholarly communication from the ground up, that is kind of get past the research paper model. There will always be a role for research papers, but get past that as the sort of standard model, as well as the research book model. We're going to have to re-engineer many of our traditional products, including grammars. And within descriptive linguistics and documentary linguistics, grammars are going to be one of the most difficult products to re-engineer because they're probably one of the most complicated. But the challenge here is if we sort of re-engineer and rethink this, we want to find a way to take advantage of the distributed modes of publication, the ease of publication, all of these things that the web offers us without at the same time losing anything of value. So this is kind of the tension I want to explore. Before I do that, I want to try to sort of construct my own history relevant to the rest of this talk of what I have lately tried to call maybe digital linguistics in opposition to computational linguistics. By digital linguistics, what I mean is the process through which we apply new digital tools and technologies to do the work that we want to do as linguists, as opposed to computational linguistics, which is generally used for problems relating to how we get computers to understand languages and language data, right? So this is more about how we get computers to help us do our work as scholars as linguists, not how we get a computer to translate, you know, Spanish to French or something like that. I think if we look at the, I'm calling this the first phase. I have a very sort of short historical memory in calling this the first phase. I'm really talking about the last decade. Obviously, there was a lot of work in digital linguistics before 2000 or even the 90s, before the World Wide Web, but there really was an explosion maybe since around 2000 or so. And the first phase was largely reactive. And what I mean by that is there was a recognition that there was a need to intelligently fit new technologies onto existing models of practice. In particular, there was work by people like Gary Simons and Stephen Bird awakening us to problems of sort of loss of data because of, you know, formats degrading or not being able to use, you know, certain kinds of technologies that would sort of stop working after a few years, and that sort of problem. And so what we have is work like Bauhues and Bird's work on interlinear glossed text, sort of telling us how to take a traditional format and reformulate it to some extent with this new technology, but not really necessarily asking us to completely rethink the nature of textual glossing, though there was some work like that in other domains. Similar work on linguistic paradigms, and for myself in 2004, I had a paper on grammatical descriptions that I would largely say is in this retrofitting domain. It was reactive. How do I take an existing grammar and turn it into something like an XML object or something to that effect? Some work went a little bit beyond this to some extent. I don't think it quite got to the re-engineering level that I'm talking about today, but certainly Bird and Simon's 2003 paper, now a classic paper to a large extent, on portability, tried to take some of the lessons we'd learned from these acts of retrofitting, right, that we learned from all the data that was disappearing, and try to codify it into some general principles, sort of general principles of encoding our resources in these new these new technologies, in these new formats. I think Nordhoff's 2008 paper, Grammars, to some extent does this as well, tries to codify principles for what a good grammatical description would be like to help us deal with this process of migrating from this sort of pre-digital age to this digital age. What's nice, I think, is on the whole, we have an idea as a field of how to avoid technological harm as these new technologies come into place. I'm not saying we always manage to do it, but when a new technology comes in, we pretty much sort of know how to make sure we don't use it in a way that causes us to lose material, lose information, lose resources. We sort of solve some of the archiving and reusability and distribution problems. And so now we actually have the luxury of thinking about doing really new things. And a lot of the rest of this talk for me is inspired by actually a blog post. I think it's the first time I'm citing a blog post in a talk by Cameron Nyland, who is a chemist or something. To be honest, I don't really know what he is. I just sort of read his blog posts on scholarly communication a lot. And he had a post, and I'm adapting it here somewhat, but he tried to break down the notion of publishing into separate component pieces so we could try to understand what it would mean to, say, rebuild a publishing regime. I'm not focusing on publishing in the rest of the talk here, but I'm using this as an example, and then I want to kind of apply this model to grammars to some extent. So he breaks down publishing into sort of separate, a dimension like registering, where so one aspect of publishing is just saying, hey, I have an idea, it's my idea, here it is, right? Here's a date on it. There's also a filtering aspect of publishing. We're all quite familiar with this, with the notions of peer review, but obviously in the web age, we don't need to really limit publications to paper, but we still need to find a way to help someone get those facts, get that information, get those papers that they want to. So peer review is one kind of filtering mechanism, you know, but Google now is another kind of filtering mechanism. So there's this filtering aspect to publishing where publishers now often act as that filter, but there are other ways to have that filter to get the sort of information and the facts we want. Curation is something that I'm going to come back to in particular when it comes to grammars, but there's this curatorial aspect that we can probably never get away from. Even if we entered a world where we stopped writing as many papers and instead were publishing databases or these more sort of distributed factual objects, there will probably always be a place, and I think this is something that Sebastian Druda was referring to in his talk, for having a coherent story-like object, right? Whether it's a grammar as a sort of physical book-like object with an order to it, with structure, whether it's a research paper. As humans, we're always going to like to have these stories, and even if we start producing fewer of them in the future than we are today, we probably still will have this place to have a sort of complete coherent chunk that sort of says, this is what it is, this is the state of the art at this moment. Then, of course, there's also the sort of archival and reusability aspect of publishing, right? So we want to make sure one of the acts of publishing is to make sure the information will be around for a long time. And reusability, and often that comes out today in the nature of citation, which is you have an idea, I want to use your idea, say I'm using your idea, and use it to create another new idea, right? So these are some of the different functions that the publishing regime traditionally on paper has offered us, but we can sort of rethink them now and break them apart in principle with the web, right? And there might be some others as well. This is just one adaptation or analysis. Well, I want to look a little bit at what it might mean to try to deconflate grammar and grammar writing and sort of separate it into its component pieces. I'll have some initial proposal here, certainly not the final word. We've already had, I think, at least one prominent, at least partly technology-driven deconflation in grammar in the last decade or more. And that's the one that we're all familiar with here in a context like this of documentation versus description, right? Now, I think it's probably fair to say that people decades ago or a century ago probably had some idea that there was a difference between documentation and description. But before these new technologies that allowed us to really create very distinctive products, one that you could point to and say this is prototypical documentation, and another that you could point to and say this is prototypical description, these particular categories didn't come into sharp relief, but the technology really gives us an opportunity and forces us to consider this in more detail, even if we were sort of more vaguely aware of it before. I also want to say that, of course, grammatical description itself has always been informally subdividable. It's always been the case that one person could write descriptive phonology and someone else could write a descriptive morphology. It's never been the case that one person had to do the whole thing. But I do want to explore the idea that the web, and in particular the semantic web, really allows us to take this aspect of subdividing the topics of a grammar to a logical extreme. Rather than viewing a grammar as a single object, we can really view it as a kind of database, a collection of quite disparate facts, but then unified in different ways for certain kinds of presentation or explanatory purposes. I'm not going to go into detail exactly about what the semantic web is, but for those of you who aren't particularly familiar with it, I want to just give a few comments on it just to clarify some of the later discussion. The key idea behind the semantic web is you take the regular web that we're all familiar with, right? So we all read newspaper articles, go to Facebook, do all these sorts of things. And the regular web is mostly oriented towards sort of display of resources for human consumption. But what you try to do is overlay on it a sort of separate web using the same technologies, but a web of facts, a web with meaning, right? But we're going to use a lot of the same resources that we use for the regular World Wide Web, and in that way, these facts will be as accessible by a human or a machine as any regular web page is today. To give you an example of what this kind of semantic web might look like in linguistic terms, here's a sort of a diagram. And what you want to do is think of these sort of different circles, like here, as something like a web page, only it's sort of a web page of meaning. It's a web page that means something like I'm referring to the real world notion of English. And we want to just start saying things about it in a web-like way with linking mechanisms that we're sort of accustomed to from the regular web pages. So we might say, here's a thing called English. It's a daughter of, say, West Germanic. You know, it has some sort of language code. We might want to start saying more interesting things about it. Maybe that there's a resource that documents English here, right? And this resource contains a particular example, and that provides us some core data. Later on, we might derive and actually state this all, not merely in our descriptive grammar, but on the web itself in a machine-readable way, that while based on this example, I find that this is an instance of SVO word order, and we may even go further and say that this instance of SVO word order justifies assigning English a typological type of an SOV language, right? So you want to try to take this idea of making these sort of small low-level statements, stick them onto the World Wide Web to make them public, and then ideally you want to kind of scale this up, right? So you've got this dense network of relationships, this dense network of knowledge. These are somewhat emerging technologies and emerging ideas, but there's an increasing amount of work about how to take human knowledge and encode it in this way to make it exploitable in a web sense. I think if we apply this notion to grammars to some extent, what we can do is if we think of a traditional publication of view of a grammar, it's a monograph, it's a big, thick book, right? We're all quite accustomed to that. But this sort of semantic web view of a grammar lets us think of it instead as a large set of facts, right? I think a lot of us have this notion intuitively. I'm not trying to say that this is a particularly new observation, but it's that these new technologies, these new ideas are really bringing this kind of model into a kind of sharper focus than we could have had before. And it also means that what might have just been a conceptual idea 50 years ago or 20 years ago is something we could actually implement and try to do something actively with today. What would this set of facts look like? Well, there's a series of low-level, boring grammatical generalizations. You know, oh, look, I found a minimal pair illustrating a distinction between P and B, right? Sort of low-level thing. Higher-level organizing principles, taking those small sets of minimal pairs and trying to produce a phonemic system from them. Maybe you're also trying to do something that I think came up in some of the other talks or the question period, some imposition of consistency in terminology. That would distinguish sort of a proper full grammatical description from sort of a wild set of facts just living on the web. There should be some consistency in terminology. And also some sense of completeness in the context of the available data and in the context of what it means in current linguistic theory to have whatever a complete grammatical description is. I think if we sort of take this web view of a grammar and try to pull all these pieces apart, all these distinct sets of facts, so what we run into the one immediate problem, which I got into with some of those separate dimensions just a second ago, I'm just sort of calling here the Humpty Dumpty problem. I don't know how cross-cultural this nursery rhyme thing is, but he was a big egg that sat on the wall and broke, and no one knew how to put him back together again, right? So there's something quite attractive about taking all of these individual facts in the grammar and pulling them apart. There's something even quite attractive about having the semantic web notion that might allow different people to examine the same documentation and just state the little generalizations they've discovered, not in a coherent picture, but hey, look, I found a minimal pair. I'm going to state that fact. I'm going to register it. It's going to be available to anyone who cares about minimal pairs in that language. There's something attractive about that. But at the same time, there's probably always going to be a place for the complete story grammar, a place that you can turn to and get the complete picture of that language. And then I think in order to do that, what we need to think about is how to take all of these disparate pieces that the web might encourage us to think about and bring them back together. I think two of the concepts, in terms of bringing them back together, there's two at least initial concepts that come to mind, and that is thinking about the aspects of coverage and coherence. I'm going to develop these in more detail, but basically I can state one small fact of a language, but it somehow fails to be a grammar because a grammar should be more than a fact, right? It should have greater coverage, however we just choose to define coverage. I can also state a bunch of facts about a grammar, but if they're all incoherent and contradicting each other, that's another problem, right? Those facts are somehow not as good as if they don't contradict each other. I also think that coverage itself can be understood as a specialized instance of data modeling. That is, we could try to produce a data model of what a complete grammar should look like in some sense, right, and use sort of standard tools from database construction. And coherence is just a specialized instance of data validation. But they're specialized just for us, so it's going to be up to us to come up with these models and validations. But we might be able to use tools that are already existing tools or models that help us with general data modeling and general data validation to help us get ahead with there. But a lot of this is going to be our domain, because obviously only we really understand grammars. I'm going to come back to sort of coverage and then coherence, talk about them in more detail. There probably are at least two dimensions to coverage to consider when considering the sort of web view of grammars. One is internal coverage. That is the strength of an account with respect to existing documentation, right? So whatever the documentary record happens to be, we want to make sure our grammar covers everything in that documentary record. There's also a kind of top-down notion of coverage, which is however strong the account is with respect to some general notion of whatever we think a complete grammatical description is. Obviously, that evolves, but we do have a sense as a field that some grammatical descriptions cover more of the things we expect them to than others. So these are sort of two separate dimensions of coverage that we need to think about in modeling separately. I think external coverage has probably seen more explicit attention, at least since the Comrie-Smith questionnaire and probably before, but that was already an attempt to sort of think about what the full external coverage might be of a grammar. And I think if we think about researching internal coverage, there hasn't been as much work on that, but it could complement other documentary work. We might think about, for instance, you know, what sample size of your full set of documentary materials is likely to be representative of the whole set. There's not much work on this as far as I know, but it is the kind of thing we could think about. How about implementing coverage, right, in a sort of some sort of computational sense? Well, we've got some tools that can help us along, right? Some of the annotation tools like Elan, I think, would help us implement coverage. Some aspects of Flex, I think, the Flex tool probably help us implement coverage. Some of the questionnaires out there, though they're not formalized, help us implement external coverage. We've got some tools out there to help us understand what this might mean. We still, though, I think, need models and tools for helping us understand what it means to obtain representative documentary samples, right, as opposed to just cherry-picking the samples that we happen to need to make a particular argument. We also, I think, need some kind of formal consensus of external coverage if we're really to sort of realize the computational power of this. We really need linguists to sit down and say, this is more or less what full external coverage looks like. I think that would be possible, though somewhat difficult, but possible if we really wanted to do it. So that was coverage. Moving on to coherence a bit. There's at least there's several different aspects of coherence we can talk about. Four kind of dimensions that I have thought about here, at least, would be one is just consistency in use of terminology. I think we've talked about that already today to some extent. For language-specific categories, we want to use them consistently. We also want to talk about explicit relationships between these categories and comparative concepts, which I think is also another dimension of coherence, right? So if I don't know what your language-specific categories mean, then it's hard for me to really sort of make sure that they actually are doing something reasonable. Something else that has just come up in the last talk and has come up at other times today is the idea that we would like to have some degree of compatibility of analyses across the described grammatical patterns. I think that's sort of fairly clear and obvious, and there's been some work on that. And then in addition, and this might sound a little simpler than what I mean it to be, so I want to qualify it a bit, the idea that the descriptive claims are fully supported by the documentary record, I don't mean here the standard and quite wonderful practice of pulling out descriptive data or data from your documentation to support your descriptive claim. That's fine. That's just sort of taking one piece of data to sort of illustrate generally what you're saying. What we really want, though, is something stronger, which is that nothing else in the entire documentary record contradicts what you've said. And we don't necessarily have sort of great support for that other direction. It's gotten better to pull a nice illustrative example out of the documentation, but not as good to make sure that there's nothing else in there that could have falsified what you said. People have thought about that, definitely, but it's just not particularly well supported. How might we sort of implement coherence, right, if we think of it that way? What does it mean to sort of put it together and look at these various pieces? What we have in terms of implementing coherence, well, we have tools like GOLD, right, the General Ontology for Linguistic Description, which is still to some extent a flawed tool, but it's trying to give us a set of terms that would allow us to take our language-specific categories, right, and relate them to more general linguistic notions. It's the beginning of something. We have some grammar engineering tools. I think we're going to hear about those tomorrow. We've heard about some just now in the previous talk that help us make sure that all of our rules are fitting together coherently. They're not contradicting each other. They help us build computational grammars to make sure that all of our example sentences sort of deal with each other and parse the way that's, parse the way we expect them to, and there are no contradictions that come in line. There are many other things we might need. I think my impression, if someone knows of other tools in this, please let me know, is that most of the authoring tools that are focus on morphology and syntax. We don't have great tools necessarily yet for describing phonology. We can describe phonemic inventories, but I'm not aware of a tool necessarily, maybe Flex does this and I just don't know, to say state the phonotactics of a language, right, and just to make sure that your various transcribe strings don't violate your phonotactic generalizations. We don't have tools necessarily to help us deal with, you know, prosody and all these kinds of things to describe prosodic patterns that might go into your documentation and even check an F0 to make sure that it somehow matches in some way what you said. I think phonology is probably underworked on in this case compared to morphosyntax, probably largely because morphosyntax is better represented with transcription strings. We probably need, again, better terminology management software. This has come up in some of the other talks. That really make it much easier for linguists to say what their terms mean, to define them, right, and to sort of look at them in other contexts, and probably all sorts of other things as well, right, other ways to validate our data, to make sure that all of our data is fitting together into a coherent pattern. Let me try to summarize this a bit with some pictures that hopefully kind of illustrate the basic points. So I think if we try to understand this kind of web view of a grammar, what we're looking at is a core documentation of some sort, right, like what we have here. And at least at the first stage, we just have a bunch of small statements made on top of that documentation, a bunch of low-level generalizations, not necessarily coming together into a clear picture, right? With just, in this case, well, I've made a bunch of dots. Maybe this is good coverage of the documentation, maybe not. I don't know, because I don't yet have a tool that tells me if this sort of sampling of the documentation is going to be representative of the rest of it. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So we need some tool to help us understand when I've looked at enough of the documentation, right? And then we're going to want some other sets of tools that allow us to filter these various low-level generalizations, analyze them, and may perhaps re-describe them in a way that brings them together into sort of one coherent picture that gives us what we're calling coherent internal coverage, which again has two distinct dimensions. One is bringing all these generalizations into sort of one pretty straight line picture here, if you'll let the metaphor fly through. Just pretend this means it's coherent, right, with all the lines in a straight arrow. But secondarily, we also have to have an idea about the extent to which, did I lose my mouse here? Here it go. Well, it disappeared. Oh, here it is. It's on my little monitor. Now it's back to you. All right. The extent to which these various connections here into our notion of kind of internal coverage are also sort of covering everything we might want them to cover. So we're going to need to cover this domain. And then we're going to have some other layer on the top here that indicates some external coverage. And the external coverage is going to try to relate to our internal coverage of the documentation and give us some idea of how our bits of internal coverage relate to more general linguistic notions and also things. And also the extent to which our external, the bits of our internal coverage up here match onto all the different things that we think are important to be covered in a fully sort of exemplary externally covered grammar, right? So this diagram is quite informal. I'm not saying it really tells us the whole picture that's coming through here, but I think it conveys some impression and begins to give us some idea of the different kinds of areas of the process of creating grammatical descriptions where we're going to need different tools and methods to sort of check and help us deal with these two issues of sort of coherence and coverage in different ways. All right, so let me just try to finish up the last few minutes with a conclusion of sorts. One first point I want to make here, and I sort of hinted at this a bit at the beginning when I said that a lot of this talk is inspired by looking at more general work on the nature of scholarly communication. There's going to be lots of changes in scholarly communication, whether we like it or not. A lot of the problems are going to be much bigger than linguistics, and we're just going to be hooking on to what these other fields are doing, fields with more resources, medical fields, biology. And so one of the important points, one of the important things to do there, though, is to sort of try to keep apprised of that work. I don't want to sort of make a kind of weak claim of say we should be more collaborative because everyone says we should collaborate more, and that's really hard. But what we can at least do is be reading what the biologists and the chemists, these various fields are doing, and sort of seeing where scholarly communication might be going. They have a much more active discussion of this than we do, is my impression. And then within that, we need to start carving out those problems that are clearly our own domain. So here, I think two problems that are clearly our own domain are the notions of grammatical coverage and coherence. Now, it might be the case that the generalized notions of coverage and coherence are applicable in other domains. And we might need to look at, say, what the biological model of coverage might be for some data set and borrow some of their tools again. But when it comes to grammar, either we do it and do it right, or someone else might do it and do it terribly. So it really is kind of our domain to really take control of. Now, something else, I think in the way that we typically frame these web experiences and even wiki models, we tend to think often about these things as kind of distributed acts, right? All the work is distributed across different pieces, distributed authors. But it's also important to keep in mind that single author grammars involve one individual distributed across time, right? We've all dealt with the fact that we've written something down, come back to it a year later, or if we're unlucky, a day later, and have no idea what we said. So these kinds of tools that sort of help us achieve coherence and coverage are also useful for the single author context. So even though it was the sort of, for myself at least, this inspiration of web models that let me down this road of thinking, they really also apply to the single author case and not necessarily the fully distributed case because, well, each of us are different instantiations of ourselves in different days and tend to be, well, I'm at least frequently incoherent across different instantiations of myself and would love to have a tool to help me get past that. And then just to sort of summarize in the sort of last thing, and whether or not you like the particular points I made about grammars here, whether they all seem to fit, whether you have other ideas of how we should be re-engineering and rethinking our grammars, I think we've reached a level of maturity in this kind of domain of digital linguistics where we're pretty good at this retrofitting problem. Even if we don't always do it right, even if we don't always have the resources, even if we sometimes cheat, right, and don't do what we're supposed to do, even if we open up Microsoft Word and start typing away if we know we're not supposed to, but we know how to retrofit properly if we want to. But the next step is really going to be a harder and much more interesting step of really trying to reconceptualize all of these products, you know, get away from the paper medium, and really at each stage say, what does this new medium of communication mean? what could I do differently? What can I rethink? And I think I'll just stop with that. 1 minute left.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks,
and I'll put some references up. You can look at them.